A new day, a new president in Egypt. Today, Wednesday, July 4th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Mohamed Morsi is ousted after just a year in office. Some Egyptians welcome the military's move.
We needed a president who's more open-minded, more tolerant, more willing to accept democracy, freedom of expression, and these are all issues that the former president Morsi stood against.
But Morsi supporters are calling it nothing short of a coup.
No, you cannot do that. This is democracy. We play democracy by the rule better than the other side.
Egypt, it seems, could get noisier.
You may see even more demonstrations down the road. This is only the beginning of Revolution 2.0.
Plus, new security measures for Boston's July 4 celebrations. It's looking a lot more like Belfast or Jerusalem today.
ERI's The World is supported by Medtronic. Medtronic Philanthropy expands access to chronic disease health care for the underserved through programs that strengthen health systems, promote healthy communities, and magnify the philanthropic efforts of its 43,000 employees worldwide. More at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com. And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, the studio behind Juno and Little Miss Sunshine, presenting the new summer comedy, The Way, Way Back, starts tomorrow.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. What's happening in Egypt is truly astonishing. After just a year in office, Egypt's first freely elected president, Mohamed Morsi, has been deposed by the Egyptian military. That was yesterday. Today, Morsi is believed to be in the army's custody, and security forces have moved to arrest hundreds of leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood. Morsi was once a top figure in that Islamist organization. Also today, Egypt has a new interim president, a former high court judge. There still are many huge questions about what's next for this pivotal Arab nation of 90 million people. The World's Matthew Bell begins our coverage.
Adli Mansour was so new to his former position as Chief Justice of Egypt's Constitutional Court, he hadn't even sworn in yet. So he took two oaths of office today. The first made him Supreme Court Justice. Then Mansour was sworn in as Egypt's new interim president. Mansour spoke about the continuity of the spirit of the revolution. He said Egyptians have to put an end to leader worship. Fresh elections, Mansour said, are the only way forward. It's not clear when they would take place, but for now, many Egyptians are more focused on celebrating the downfall of President Mohamed Morsi. On the street in Cairo, Mahdi Hamad told the BBC that he knelt down and prayed when he heard the news that Morsi was out. "We're tired of this man," he said. "We need respectable people to run the country from now on." Morsi, who found himself under house arrest, denounced the military's decision to remove him from power. In a video that briefly appeared online, Morsi described himself as the legitimate, democratically elected leader of Egypt. Morsi said there are deadly attempts underway to steal the revolution and that he was issuing an order to the police and the army to keep the peace, avoid bloodshed, and return to legitimacy. Morsi called for a dialogue to move the country forward in a lawful manner. In the coastal city of Alexandria, clashes broke out between rival groups of demonstrators. Similar scenes played out in other parts of the country, and at least 10 people were killed and dozens injured. Security forces launched a sweeping crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood. The group's spiritual leader, Mohamed Badieh, was arrested, and authorities have issued a wanted list of some 200 other leaders from the Islamist group. Supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood say they're not backing down, and that the recent actions of the Egyptian military do not mean the end of political Islam in Egypt. These men spoke to the BBC outside of a mosque in Cairo.
Political Islam is the people's choice. We agreed that we are going to play by democracy. And the presidential and the parliamentary election proved that political Islam is the people's choice. So there is no way it will go back underground.
This is not about political Islam. This is about constitutional legitimacy. Taking down the entire democratic process will not take down political Islam. It will bring down a lot more than that. It will take the freedom. This is the essence of the 25 January revolution, and that's the story.
But Mohamed Morsi's tenure as president galvanized a potent, if not unified, set of opposition forces. These included supporters of the previous regime under Hosni Mubarak, along with Egyptian revolutionaries. Morsi was seen by many Egyptians as a leader working first and foremost for the benefit of the Muslim Brotherhood, not the entire nation that he promised to serve when he came into office last summer. Those applauding the downfall of President Morsi are calling the events of recent days a second revolution, even if some are deeply wary of the Egyptian military's role in the country's political future. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Call it a military coup or call it a second revolution, but whatever you call it, what just happened in Egypt is this. An Islamist leader with ties to the Muslim Brotherhood was removed from power after being democratically elected. And that fact is now being digested across the Arab and Muslim world. Robin Wright is a longtime reporter and observer of the Middle East and Muslim politics. Her latest book is Rock the Kasbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. And Robin, what does the military's removal of Mohamed Morsi in Egypt mean for Islamist groups around the region? They must be really looking at this carefully.
This is a huge setback for groups across the region after struggling for decades to enter mainstream politics. Many of them had done quite well in the first democratic elections. And what happened to the Muslim Brotherhood, the granddaddy of all Islamist movements in the Arab world, will send shockwaves across Islamist politics.
When Egypt went through its revolution 2 years ago, there was an assumption that that was the opportunity for the Muslim Brotherhood to get power. After seeking power for years, suddenly they could get that power through the ballot box. If Egypt is a template for the region, does this indicate that getting Islamist groups into a secular system doesn't really work?
Well, the question among many Islamists may well be, is democracy open enough to be inclusive of Islamists? And that's a dangerous bottom line. I think the Islamists are not finished. There are still a strong percentage of people in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, clearly in Syria and elsewhere, who will turn to the Islamist parties. When Egypt goes back to the polls, there will be a core of supporters who will try to elect the Muslim Brotherhood kind of in political revenge for what's happened to them over the last 48 hours.
For the true secularists who aim for a pluralistic democratic society inclusive of everyone, isn't this also a failing for them that an Islamist party can't seem to make lasting inroads?
Well, the bottom line for Egypt is that the secular opposition has been dysfunctional over the past year, too. It was really the kids who mobilized yet again public sentiment. They began in the spring a petition campaign, going out on the streets, going out on the internet, getting signatures, a total of somewhere between 15 million and 22 million signatures demanding that Morsi step down. This totaled, even if you take the lower figure, more votes against Morsi than he won at the polls. And they are the only people who come out clean in this very traumatic and very complicated political crisis. The secular politicians have not emerged as an alternative yet. They have been unable to coalesce into viable alternatives. There's no Lech Walesa, there's no Nelson Mandela in Egypt. And the military engaged in a coup, and that's not a very democratic process either. So the big struggle will be who can emerge as an alternative in Egypt over the next probably quite turbulent year.
So something like this happens in Egypt, call it a coup, call it a second revolution, whatever it is. I mean, Egypt is influential. I'm already hearing about copycat demonstrations in Tunisia. How might this actually ripple across the region?
That's a wonderful question. Tamarad, which was the young movement that organized the petition drive, has already been replicated in Tunisia, where they're calling for protests there against a government that is led by an Islamist party. It'll be quite interesting. The amazing thing about what's happened, besides just the specific ouster of President Morsi, is the sense that people can go out on the street still. They can demand accountability, that it's not just about getting the old autocrats out of power. It's really about creating alternatives that will address their demands. The tragedy is that because of the insecurity, because of the world economic situation, there is no easy economic solution in sight. And that may lead to greater instability, a longer term in finding ways to better life, more equitably distribute resources. So you may see even more demonstrations down the road. This is only the beginning of Revolution 2.0.
Robin Wright, her latest book is Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. Robin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So as for Washington, where does the tumult in Egypt leave things? To try to answer that, we turn to Michael Singh. Singh is managing director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He was previously at the National Security Council, a senior director for Middle East Affairs. Michael, events in Egypt are moving so fast. Does Washington have any real leverage there at this point?
Well, Marco, it's very hard to exercise influence during a crisis like this, during chaos like this. It's really what you do before this kind of crisis that gives you influence. And so right now, you know, the Obama administration is largely watching, is largely waiting to see how this is going to play out on the streets, hoping that the situation on the street will calm down so that then they can come in and exercise some influence over whoever ends up in control.
Are you saying that the White House let its eye off the ball before the crisis?
Well, I think that's right. You know, when Hosni Mubarak was president of Egypt, we largely dealt with him and his inner circle, and we didn't focus, I think, enough on preparing for what might come next, even though all of us had a sense that there really wasn't much of a plan B in Egypt. Mubarak had no successor. In a sense, we made exactly the same mistake when Mubarak was ousted, just sort of dealing with whoever was in charge and not thinking enough about civil society, about mass movements, about the other players on the scene who might suddenly become important in a crisis.
We know U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has been making calls to his Egyptian counterpart. How strong are Washington's links with Egypt's military at this point?
Well, fortunately, we do have strong links with Egypt's military by virtue of the fact that we've been providing Egypt's military with this $1.3 or $1.5 billion in aid for over 30 years now. And that aid has not just been in the form of tanks and jets, but in the form of training, education, officer exchanges, things which build institutional linkages between our military and the Egyptian military.
Is any of that aid in jeopardy?
Well, that aid is in jeopardy simply because there is a law on the books in the United States which says that if a country conducts a military coup, you know, deposes a democratically elected government, that U.S. assistance has to be suspended. Now, of course, it's up to the Obama administration to decide if this, in fact, qualifies as a coup. And I think there are arguments that will be made internally that no, in fact, this isn't a coup under that particular definition.
And the fact that non-essential U.S. embassy employees have been sent home, is that pro forma or is there something to read into that?
Officials here in Washington are very worried about what will come next, because unlike in January 2011, where really was the Mubarak regime against all of the protesters, Islamists and secular alike, and when the army wouldn't intervene for Mubarak, there was really no one on Mubarak's side. Now you have these two different camps of people out in the streets, the Islamists who support Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood, and then the secular forces who are sort of arrayed against the Islamists and have now the support of the army. It's not clear that the Islamists are simply going to sort of fade into the background here. So there could be a second act to this particular revolution, and that act could be quite violent.
Understandably, I guess the U.S. seems to be playing a wait-and-see game before staking out any sort of position. Can you envision the outcome, positive or negative, that would push the U.S. to be more deeply engaged in what's going on in Egypt now?
I think what they'll do now is they'll push the military and they'll push the other sort of political power centers in Egypt to move very quickly to a transition to civilian rule. And that may not take the form of elections right away, but I think the Obama administration wants to see some kind of civilian coalition in charge in Egypt.
Well, Michael Singh, Managing Director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
Still ahead, checking in with the American Revolution, the celebration of it, that is, and how the July 4th party has changed here in Boston. You're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic. Medtronic Philanthropy expands access to chronic disease health care for the underserved through programs that strengthen health systems, promote healthy communities, and magnify the philanthropic efforts of its 43,000 employees worldwide. More at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com. And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, the studio behind Juno and Little Miss Sunshine, presenting the new summer comedy The Way, Way Back. Starts tomorrow.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Our GeoQuiz today is aimed at those of you toiling in front of a hot, smoky grill. Maybe you're searing steaks, flipping burgers, or getting creative with homemade shish kebabs. The point is, you're cooking over fire. It's not just an American tradition. You can find people grilling meat and veggies in just about every culture. But let's get creative for the next few minutes, people. Where would you find a crazed barbecue master grilling ice cream? We're not going to give you much time here. It's in the region bordered by Armenia, Russia, Iran, and the Caspian Sea. It's where Stephen Reichlin discovered this deliciously cool yet searing treat. He's the author of the book Planet Barbecue, and he's traveled to more than 50 countries in search of the best flame-cooked meals. Stephen, take us to a few of your favorite places you discovered around the globe where food and fire go hand in hand.
Well, number one would be Uruguay in South America. It is absolutely one of the hotbeds of grilling. One of the few places in the world where people grill exclusively over wood, and people will grill everything from steak to whole steer. Another of my favorite destinations is Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan has a fantastic tradition of kebabs, grilled vegetables, and I even experienced grilled ice cream in Azerbaijan.
What happens with grilled ice cream on a grill? Well, I can only imagine.
This was a crazy grill master, and he takes balls of ice cream, dips them in beaten egg, shredded coconut, and skewers them, and grills the ice cream over a screaming hot fire over a grateless grill called a Mongol. And what happens is the heat sets the egg and coconut, forming a shell that seals in the ice cream.
Wow, that sounds out of control. I love it.
Yeah, it's pretty spectacular.
That's obviously on the more extreme end of what you can actually do with a grill and some fire. But if you go back to the primitive side, this is basically a piece of meat over a flame. If you take something like shish kebab, though, then how does something like kebab actually vary around the world?
Well, shish kebab, I mean, first of all, the word shish kebab comes from the Turkish words shish means sword, kebab means meat. It morphs, let's see, in Peru, it would be called anticuchos, and it is a skewer of beef heart marinated with fiery chilies and served with a fiery chili sauce. In France, it becomes a brochette. In Greece, it's called souvlaki. And as you continue around Planet Barbecue, you find lula kebab, which is a minced lamb kebab enjoyed throughout the Caucasus Mountains and Central Asia.
So I'd like you to just take us to two places which seem to be on your barbecue joint bucket list. One is on the west coast of France and a meal you discovered there. Describe it for us.
Yeah, it's a specialty of a restaurant called La Bouvette on the Île de Ré, which is an island on the west coast of France. And it consists simply of mussels that are grilled over a pine needle fire. The pine needles catch fire, and in this whoosh of flame and smoke, the pine needles smoke and grill open the mussel. Basically, two ingredients, absolutely extraordinary flavor.
Oh my God, you're killing me. Okay, the other place you highlight is Karim's in India, where you sampled pretty incredible variation of tandoori grilled chicken.
Indian barbecue is characterized by its intense spicing. So you start with a yogurt marinade, there's pureed ginger and garlic, coriander, cumin, cardamom, cinnamon, very intense flavor. In India, the barbecue is all about the spicing, as opposed to a country like Argentina, where the primary seasoning is just salt and wood smoke. So very different approach.
So, Stephen, I was just in New Orleans where I had oysters with a garlicky butter grilled over an open flame, which was, I got to say, a revelation. What is the best, most unexpected thing you've ever eaten that was grilled?
Well, you know, one dish that always makes eyes pop and jaws drop around here is something I call caveman T-bone. And you take a T-bone steak, season it very generously with salt and pepper, and you lay it directly on the embers of a charcoal or wood fire. You cannot get more primal. Actually, an American president named Dwight Eisenhower used to serve this at the White House. And then I do it with a hellfire hot sauce. You put a skillet on the fire and you pan fry jalapeno chilies, garlic, and cilantro. And you pour that screaming, sizzling mixture over your caveman T-bone. It's hard to imagine a dish that's more electrifying.
Stephen Reichlin, author of Planet Barbecue, doesn't get much more primitive than this. His story called The World on a Grill is featured in Saveur magazine this month. Stephen, thanks so much.
Thank you. Grill on.
In case you still don't know the answer, it's Azerbaijan, where Planet Barbecue's Stephen Reichlin discovered grilled ice cream. And if hot ice cream isn't your thing, we have a link to Stephen's recipe for chicken wings at theworld.org. A little more on the conventional side of grilling. Reporter Deepak Singh lives in Virginia, but he recently went home to India to visit family in Lucknow. And he sent us some personal thoughts about observing July 4th in another country.
Visiting my parents in India, I decided to take my American-born daughter, who's almost 4, to the elementary school I attended in Lucknow. As soon as we entered the premises, she said, "Papa, look, the squirrels are so tiny." She was right. The squirrels she was used to seeing in the U.S. were 3 times as big. I had nothing to compare them with when they ran up and down the towering knotty Ashok trees, the same ones I ran around as a child. We walked inside the building and saw kids in gray uniforms sitting in front of teachers in blue saris. I stood outside the room and pictured myself sitting somewhere among the students. While my mind took me back 30 years, my daughter said, "Too many kids, Papa." When I sat on a squeaky wooden chair among 50 students here, it never occurred to me that there were more students than could fit in that tiny room. I took it as normal. My daughter goes to a preschool in the U.S. where the student-teacher ratio is 10 to 1. I tried to explain her that schools in India are different, but she wasn't happy with my answer. We went on and saw little kids walking between classes carrying bags heavier than themselves. I used to do the same thing, bending forward, balancing the weight. Then I looked at my daughter expecting her to say, "Why doesn't the school have lockers like my school?" I found her looking at the walls that had pictures of Jawaharlal Nehru and Mahatma Gandhi instead of Abraham Lincoln. We walked out to the playground where all the kids had lined up for assembly. After a small speech by the principal, everyone started singing the Indian national anthem. I felt a little nostalgic, and then it dawned on me that it would soon be the 4th of July. 3 years ago on that day, I sang the Star Spangled Banner at Thomas Jefferson's home Monticello in Charlottesville, Virginia, and took the oath to become a citizen of the United States. Wandering around with my daughter and seeing things through her eyes made me think about my own identity and hers. We both belong to both places, but we see them very differently.
That's reporter Deepak Singh in Lucknow, India. Coming up later in the show, a Harvard lab staffed by war veterans tackling problems that plague the military. This is The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, for war veterans with PTSD, the 4th of July can be a difficult time.
Really well-meaning people will arrange parades and say, you know, "Look, veterans, we're giving you the front row seats for the fireworks displays. You might want to ask first, is that even something that they're okay with? Because, you know, there's a lot of people who aren't."
PRI's The World is supported by Medtronic. Medtronic Philanthropy expands access to chronic disease healthcare for the underserved through programs that strengthen health systems, promote healthy communities, and magnify the philanthropic efforts of its 43,000 employees worldwide. More at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com. And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, the studio behind Juno and Little Miss Sunshine, presenting the new summer comedy, The Way, Way Back, starts tomorrow.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. I came down today to the Esplanade here in Boston, one of this country's quintessential July 4th parties. The U.S. today celebrates its revolution. That revolution was messy, and as we heard earlier in the show, the people of Egypt are seeing just how messy revolutions can be, especially in their early days.
As for the American celebration, these festivities in Boston are the first big event since the April 15th Boston Marathon bombings. As has been reported, the marathon bombing suspects had intended to use this place as their original target. So the background to today's festivities does make things somewhat tense here at the Esplanade. I spoke with Captain Fran Leahy of the Massachusetts State Police about some of the extra measures being taken for precaution.
The state police has taken the lead role, partnering with local, state, and federal agencies to provide safety and security for people coming to the Esplanade today to have a great day. We have tried to put out the message of what people can bring and what they can't bring and how they should be prepared to go through some added security checkpoints. The public has been very cooperative with us, and in turn, we're doing our best to assist the public coming in because we want to make this the safest 4th of July and also a joyous 4th of July.
That was Captain Fran Leahy of the Massachusetts State Police. Now, Lisa Flegel, you're a Boston-based trauma counselor. You were in the thick of it in the days and weeks following the Boston Marathon bombings. You've also worked with people in Northern Ireland and in Israel in the Mideast who faced trauma. Situate us here, because this is kind of the next beat after those events, those tragic events in April at the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Where do things stand today? What are you seeing around you?
People are coming together. And the fact that they all have to contend with a new level of security actually makes them feel unified and stronger and not alone and isolated. Because the hardest thing when you are exposed to trauma is you feel helpless and you feel like you're the only one experiencing your symptoms. So in that sense, it's a very positive thing for people.
Well, let's talk about some other places that have to deal with this kind of thing every day. You've worked with people in Northern Ireland who've gone through the troubles there in Israel. Do the comparison. I mean, what have you seen there? And is this just a new reality that Americans are going to have to contend with, like the people in Northern Ireland and in London and Jerusalem and Tel Aviv?
Well, I have two organizations that I collaborate with and consult with. In Northern Ireland, it's the East Belfast Mission. And they work with mostly the loyalist paramilitary organizations. And what I've really learned from them, aside from the usual things about, you know, being careful and being afraid and how trauma impacts you, is how important it is to empower local people. What trauma does, if not treated, is it increases aggression. But if you have proper mental health services, like they do in Northern Ireland, the people who were the paramilitaries are now the leaders of the community. And they've led their community into the Good Friday Agreement, and they decommissioned their arms. And today, they have set up civil society in East Belfast because they were empowered, and people recognize that. As far as Israel goes, my partner there is the Israel Trauma Coalition, and they've really brought the notion of treating trauma into people's consciousness and sort of the macho Israeli nothing bother me thing. You know, they've made it less stigmatized to get treatment.
You talk about empowerment, and the security here is definitely empowered. I mean, there are way more security and law enforcement officials than there have been in the past. That's a big change. Does that concern you at all, this kind of heightened state of policing?
It's not the heightened state to be concerned about. I mean, I'm used to this in Israel. It's this way all the time. It has been throughout my life there. I lived there for 20 years. I myself was in the Israeli army. So that's not the issue. The issue is what you do with that power. And what also is important is that, you know, everybody was very hyped up after the marathon and in weeks afterwards, but the police had to go right back to work. So my concern really for them is their own psychological support and well-being. And it changed my attitude to be someone who really wants to feel like I'm supporting law enforcement. Because we get triggered emotionally when we feel threatened. And we really get triggered when we feel disrespected. And so the more we can be respectful of law enforcement, the more we can be respectful of each other, the less aggression's going to come out.
Well, Lisa Flegel, thank you so much for meeting me down here on the Esplanade today. Happy 4th of July.
You too.
Sounds of the Boston Pops rehearsing today. If you want to see the high security precautions along Boston's Esplanade, I've taken pictures. They're at theworld.org.
Oliver Stone's film, Born on the 4th of July, there's a scene where Vietnam vet Ron Kovic, played by Tom Cruise, is in a convertible during a 4th of July Day parade. Fireworks go off, and he has a traumatic flashback to the firefights that he was part of in Vietnam. That's the hard reality of post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's not just soldiers who are affected. There are also the war correspondents who've left the battlefield. Hana Alam is one of them. For years, she lived and reported from Iraq and other battle-scarred places in the Middle East. She's now the foreign affairs correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers and is based in Washington. Hana, when did you realize that 4th of July was a tough day for you to take part in?
Well, I think it was right after returning to the United States. You know, I would come back for summer vacation sometimes during the Iraq War, 2003, 2004, 2005. And really from the beginning, you know, it's not just fireworks, it's cars backfiring, balloons popping, any loud, sudden noises. But there's something specific about fireworks that triggers all sorts of bad memories, and not just the flashes and the sounds, but even the ash that can fall on you. You know, to me, it's sometimes reminiscent of debris from a car bombing or shrapnel from an explosion. So, I mean, there's so many things about fireworks in particular that just conjure up all sorts of memories.
So where does it take you? I mean, when this happens, is there kind of a Pavlovian response that immediately transports you back out of your comfort zone to along the Euphrates in Iraq, for example?
Sure. You want to hit the deck. That's what you've been taught when you hear loud explosions. I find myself steeling myself to stay in place, to keep smiling, to not flinch. And these are all experiences that, you know, in talking with my brothers who are combat veterans and other friends who are combat veterans or who've lived through even experiences like the Boston Marathon bombings.
So, Hana, how do you cope? Because I know even if I stay at home in Boston, it's hard to escape the concussion of 30 minutes of explosions along the Esplanade, not to mention all the other towns around Boston whose fireworks you can hear. What do you do?
Well, I avoid them. I try not to go out. Even last night, they were starting already. And, you know, I thought about going out to a little deli across the street and getting a bite to eat. And then all of a sudden, I heard the booms. And I thought, oh, I'll just make a sandwich at home.
I know you've brought up this aversion to fireworks and social media. What kind of conversation has come up?
Right. Well, I posted something on Facebook that my brother had told me about how much he, you know, loathes the fireworks displays. And this is a tough guy who survived, you know, many, you know, including an ambush on the 4th of July in Iraq several years ago. So for him, it's a very specific memory. And I posted this on Facebook and I thought, you know, maybe some veterans or other war reporters would comment, and they did. But I also got diplomats who'd been posted in dangerous places. A friend in Boston who said she almost swerved off the road recently because of a loud noise, someone setting off fireworks in anticipation of the 4th. And for her, it was just too close to the marathon bombings. You know, there was a number of people. And I also got responses from people whose communities were finding alternative ways to celebrate, you know, and offering fireworks-free nights for veterans and others who might have some combat stress.
So what do you think should be done? I mean, how do you let people, a lot of people, enjoy their fireworks on the 4th of July and also create a climate that's sensitive to people with PTSD?
Well, I think it's just raising some awareness. No one's trying to ban fireworks or strip away the fun and the beauty and the spectacle of them lighting up the sky on the 4th of July. That's part of the tradition. But it's just about a little bit of sensitivity. We're wrapping up over 10 years of wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, there's going to be an awful lot of people coming home for whom this is an issue. And sometimes really well-meaning people will arrange, you know, parades and give, say, you know, look, veterans, we're giving you the front row seats for the fireworks displays. You might want to ask first, is that even something that they're okay with? Because, you know, there's a lot of people who aren't.
You know, later today, there will be hundreds of thousands of people just in Boston alone enjoying the fireworks. As far as how that makes you feel, does it make you feel isolated each 4th of July?
No, not really. I wish I could enjoy them. As a child, I enjoyed fireworks with my brothers. I remember lighting Roman candles and, you know, having the cookout and the whole experience. And so, you know, there's a part of me that wishes I could be among the crowds looking up and saying the oohs and the ahs. But this is the way it turned out, and there's plenty of other ways to celebrate the 4th of July, and maybe as time goes by, there will be an opportunity to celebrate like that again.
Hannah Alem, foreign affairs correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, thank you very much for this perspective. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Traumatic brain injury is another signature condition for men and women who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it can be difficult to treat. It's one of the many military-related problems that a leading Harvard scientist soldier has been scrutinizing in his lab, and he's been hiring veterans to help him with his latest ideas for the battlefield. WGBH reporter Elizabeth Ross has his story.
Harvard professor and U.S. Army Major Kevin Kit Parker knows firsthand the problems that servicemen and women struggle with on the battlefield. He served two combat tours in Afghanistan, and he's witnessed the devastation caused by these improvised explosive devices, or IEDs.
A friend of mine was wounded with a traumatic brain injury, and he was improperly cared for by the military. I got upset about this, and my frustration with my friend's care and some ideas I had about brain injury, and having reviewed the literature of brain injury, I decided to get into that field.
Parker's a bioengineer, and in his lab at Harvard School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, he's been trying to understand how explosions affect brain cells. The goal is to develop better treatments for those suffering with brain injuries. But he has other research interests as well.
Over time, I went back and revisited the list of things that had pissed me off when I was in the battlefield. And I just decided to do a little bit of science for everything that pissed me off. So we've evolved this into work on camouflage, because the camouflage patterns were pretty poor in the Afghanistan desert.
As Parker's worked through his extensive fix-it list, he's recruited other veterans to help him. The student vets he hires share his desire to solve perplexing technical problems that plague the military. And they're not just American vets.
The first one was a French graduate student who spent a three-month internship with us, and he had spent his conscripted time in the French Navy chasing pirates off the coast of Somalia. He had the best stories of all the veterans.
Good. So this is the lab where we build things.
Josh Goss runs Parker's lab at Harvard. He's a Marine veteran. During a tour of the lab, Goss tells me he's working to fix a problem that he encountered during two deployments to Iraq.
As a Marine, they gave me two sets of uniforms, one green and one tan, to try to match our general environments, whether we're going to be fighting in the desert or in the woodland areas. And it turns out in the desert, we would do patrols on the Euphrates River, or we were in an island near the Euphrates, and it's lush and green, and we're wearing bright tan.
But what if that bright tan uniform could change color to match that lush green island? It's an idea that Goss and the scientists at Parker's lab are exploring. It's for a project funded by the government's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA. They've been studying marine animals like the cuttlefish and the squid, which are masters of camouflage. In this lab, inspiration often comes from unusual places.
This is probably the best $50 I ever spent at Target. It's also not the first time I've purchased scientific equipment from a local store.
The scientific equipment that Goss is referring to is a children's cotton candy maker. Goss and the team studied the toy to figure out the best way to make nanofibers. They're using the nanofibers to create the next generation of wound dressings.
This lab is sort of has a parallel feeling to the military and how the military is run.
Ian Perkins feels right at home working in Parker's lab. He's a former Army infantryman who deployed three times to Iraq.
For instance, my first summer here, we had a cleaning inspection. And that's something that is more done in the military than I would say. I don't know if your boss would ever come into your office and start wiping his fingers down on every flat surface, but that's something we do here.
Perkins and Goss first came to work in Parker's lab through a summer internship program at Harvard. For the past year, Goss has mentored Perkins and supported him as he's transitioned from a community college in Boston to a local four-year college. And that brings us to another ambitious item on Parker's agenda. He He says there should be a national plan to nurture and make use of all the veterans returning home from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
A job is not enough. A job that any knucklehead could do is a total waste of what we've invested in these young people.
He says build a plan to continue to grow and develop veterans. Then you'll have the next generation of leaders. For The World, I'm Elizabeth Ross.
You can see images from Kit Parker's bioengineering lab, including the cotton candy machine, there at theworld.org. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's July 4th, and hopefully the start of a long weekend for many of you. But even if your weekend is only 2 or 3 days, we've got a simple solution to make it feel longer. Great summer music. So joining me for a selection of our favorite summer picks is World producer April Peavy. Hi, April.
Hi, Marco.
So here we are again, both with some great music. I'm going to start, and my first pick is Latin music, because when I think summer, I think Latin music. I think Streets of New York, hydrants wide open, blasting that cool summer vibe. And if you're looking for the definitive summer Latin music, I'm going to say Tito Puente. And fortunately, he's got a new collection out, repackaged his 4 first albums. This is called Cuatro, the definitive collection, featuring a lot of his vibraphone skills as well as some of his great timbale riffs. This will really take you back. Check out this track. It's called Hong Kong Mambo from his 1958 album Dance Mania.
Love the vibes.
Yeah, it's so nice to hear those Tito Puente vibes. So what's your first pick, April?
So my first pick is Elastic Bond. They're a band from Miami. And I think what you'll find is all my picks have that sort of retro future sound to it. And you'll know what I mean when you hear them. So my first pick is Elastic Bond. And much of their music is a nod to retro soul and traditional cumbia. Elastic Bond singer Sophie Encanto is from Honduras. And here's the single Perdo El Control. So that was Elastic Bond and the first single from their album, Real.
I like it. So Fat Freddy's Drop, let me tell you about this band, which I'm going to feature next as my second pick. This is the best reggae soul outfit in New Zealand. As bandleader Chris Fitchie Fayumu has pointed out, the Maori Islanders of New Zealand really felt kind of comfort in the lyrics and music of Jamaican reggae and American soul. It's Fat Freddy's Drop latest. It's called Blackbird, and I know this is going to be on my stereo for the rest of the summer. Here's the title track. Yeah, it's hard to resist, I gotta say. So that's Fat Freddy's Drop from New Zealand, the title track from their new album, Blackbird.
Great music.
What's your next pick, April?
So my second pick is the James Hunter Six. They're a modern rhythm and blues soul band from the UK, fronted by James Hunter.
I love these guys.
Yeah, oh, they're great. And what makes their new album, it's called Minute by Minute, so special, is that it was produced by Gabriel Roth, who actually, as you know, is the co-founder of Daptone Records. So Roth has worked with Amy Winehouse and Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, mm-hmm. among others. And it just has that Daptone signature, I guess you could call it, but yet still very much remaining James Hunter Six. Here's the song Chicken Switch.
When the prize ain't worth the game, when every road leads back the way you came,
Sometimes you know. Yeah, when it's time to quit. When in doubt, take the coward's way out. Hit the chicken switch. Hey, hey, hey.
James Hunter turns into James Brown before your own eyes.
All right, Marco, so that's Chicken Switch by the James Hunter Six. What's your third pick?
So my third pick, April, and all of her picks will be featured online. My third pick is the Orchestra Polyritmo de Cotonou. It's called The Skeletal Essences of Voodoo Funk. I just love the title. Thank the precursor to New Orleans voodoo funk before it was even a genre. The Orchestra Polyritmo de Cotonou, they're from Benin in West Africa. They are huge in the 60s. They disappeared for a while but have now regrouped. This stuff on this CD, though, is archive material. And check this track out. So that's the Orchestra Polyritmo de Cotonou, a fantastic album, volume 3 of the material that has been put out of theirs by Analog Africa. April, take us out with your last pick.
I certainly will. In keeping with that old music sounding new again, it's the latest album by Daft Punk, that electric pop duo from France.
Yay.
And I think they definitely have the most hyped album of the year. And deservedly so, I might add. It's a really great album. It's called Random Access Memories. And many of the songs I really do think will become the soundtrack for the summer of 2013. Much of the music on this record harkens back to the 1970s and disco. One track features Paul Williams of the Muppets, Rainbow Connection. A couple of other tracks feature Nile Rodgers of Chic, including this one, the song that I want to go out with. It's called Give Life Back to Music by Daft Punk.
Totally feel that Chic influence with the hand claps and the up dance and vibe, kind of chop chop guitars. It's all there.
Most definitely.
Can't believe it was recorded recently. Well, some funky sounds for you to enjoy this summer. The world's April Peavy, who produces our global hit. Thanks, as always. Great stuff.
Great. Thank you.
And all of our picks, as I said, will be online at theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. More music for you now. Happy 4th of July.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can.
PRI, Public Radio International.